G'day, money miners. Welcome to the Mining News Show for 4th of May. We've got Centaurus producing their first nickel sulfate from their Jaguar mine in Brazil via their pilot plant, and Vulcan are out raising $109 million. JD, Trav, apologies for I'm a bit parched, a bit of BD work, business development last night on behalf of Money of Mine.
Someone's got to do the dirty work, mate.
Oh, so she's a bit, I've got a bit of water flowing in at the moment, so.
You've taken one for the team, mate.
Yeah, happy to help, lads. I'll do it any time you need.
I'm fully supportive of your BD work, Matty, but if you give me a call at 11:30 PM again and you sound pretty chooked up, then I won't be answering it in the future.
It was only because you answered the text first. I'm like, I may as well call him. He's obviously awake. My apologies. Right, let's get into it. Centaurus, CTM, first nickel sulfate. Sulfate produced from their pilot plant program, which has concluded. Very exciting project this in Brazil. JD, take it away, mate. What's happening in CTM territory?
Yeah, so you sort of covered it. They're going through all the MET test working at the moment. So just to rewind a bit and give a bit of scope on what Centaurus is trying to do, they're going one step further from just producing concentrate. They're trying to turn that into a nickel sulfate product, which is the key component in batteries. And that sort of ties in with their whole theme of being very ESG focused. So you can think of this somewhat akin to the lithium players trying to turn spodumene into hydroxide. They're getting that downstream value, trying to capture a bit more value, but obviously along the way, adding a bit of technical risk, a bit of complexity to the process. So the test work so far has shown that they can execute it quite well. They can get a cobalt and a zinc hydroxide product. And it's something we see in Voisey's Bay, Raglan, these other sort of well-renowned mines around the world creating these byproducts. So from an economics point of view for the project, neither these zinc or these cobalt products were previously incorporated in the project's economics. So what that means, it's something we touched on talking about Ernest Henry a couple of weeks back. These byproduct credits are credits other than the main product, in this case nickel sulfide, that the company will produce. And they can subtract that in their costs that they show to the market. And ultimately, they can show that they are a lower cost nickel producer because they subtract the revenue they're gaining from this zinc product, from this cobalt product, off of their costs for the operation at Jaguar. So getting into a bit more of the backstory now about Centaurus. So if you just pull up a chart, you'll see that the stock's off about 25%. Over the past couple months. Now, I think that's on the back of a couple different things. The DFS has been delayed. Now, this was initially planned to be out in the last quarter of 2022. So we're now expecting that to be in the last quarter of this year and final investment decision in quarter three of calendar year 2024.
Are they just drilling it out a bit further? What was the rationale for the delay there, JD?
Yeah, I think there's a couple different points of view you could take. If you're an optimist, which I know you're not, Trav, you could say
far from it.
You could say that they've had quite a bit of success at the drill bit. You could say that they're trying to optimize that production profile. That leads to the delays where they're trying to see what sort of mine life, what sort of amount of, you know, 1,000 tons per annum this thing can produce. A pessimist like yourself might say that they're having potential MET issues, which I think they've largely cleared up. That's what we've seen today, and we're going to see the last assays from these various hydroxide products within 4 weeks, the company's flagged. You could also say that they're suffering from some sort of permitting or offtake issues. I'll get into the offtake a bit more later on. And you'd also maybe question why they're going down this nickel sulfate route. We've seen a lot of other companies that produce a nickel concentrate product, and that's that. They sell that to a smelter. They sell that to a refiner. But Centaurus, they're trying to, like I said, capture that value downstream.
Probably a note as well, when you're talking about the 20% off as well, that nickel price is down 20%. this year so far. It was about $31,000 a ton US at the start of the year, and it's
exactly there's multiple reasons why the stock price is down 20 to 30%, and another one of that could be the cash position. So they did a pretty hefty raising in January of 2022. So they raised $75 million at $1.16. And just for reference, they're now trading in the high 80s, and for the past month they've been closer to the low 80s. So at the end of the last quarter, this report came out probably a week or so ago, they had $23 million of cash left. They've got 6 diamond drill rigs and an RC rig. So if you just look at that cash spend profile over the five or so quarters since they did that last raising, they're spending between 10 and 15 million bucks every quarter. So that would sort of imply that they might need to do another raise and do it quite soon, just to sort of see them through to that final investment decision, which is a bit over a year away. So maybe a year and a quarter away still. So I'm sure the company would be pretty torn about having to do it on a price that's like a discount to what they've been trading for quite a while now. But yeah, they're just going to have to bite the bullet in my opinion and raise that amount that'll see them through. Now, the other thing I mentioned before was the offtake. So Vale, the huge Brazilian miner, vended this project into Centaurus a good few years ago now. And part of the agreement was that they would have the offtake rights. Now, I believe the initial idea was that Centaurus wouldn't be producing a nickel sulfate product, because I think Vale, from my point of view, they'd have a lot less sort of value that they can add to a nickel sulfate. Previously, the idea might have been a bit more similar to what we see what we previously saw at Mincor, having the offtake with BHP and selling it to their sort of smelter. So they might try and seek some sort of compensation, or alternatively, Centaurus might try and utilize the infrastructure that Vale has in the country rather than have to truck the product, I think 900 or so Ks, to the port. So we'll sort of see what comes of that. But I'm sure once this offtake agreement is sort of fixed, then that's a sort of another tick of approval in the right direction. So overall, I'm a fan of the project. I think the team's done quite a good job. I'm pretty frustrated with the delays that they've seen. But nickel sulfate is quite complex. It's definitely going down the right path to do all these checks rather than have the engineering team build a plant that's not quite optimized. And yeah, the project looks great. Nickel sulfide, these projects are in demand. We've seen this by the M&A in the space. I don't really mind Brazil. I'm not sure what your guys' thoughts are on Brazil as a jurisdiction, but in particular, the state that they're in is a known mining state. And I'm really just focused on that DFS and the maiden reserve in the final quarter of this year. And I really want to see that done with no more delays. I want to see the management keep to their word now. It's already been a year of delays with that DFS. And if they can stick to that, I think there's a bit of upside there.
Well, it looks like the Carajás are, as you said, a very populated mining area and offtake with Vale. And I think by the sounds of what you're saying with the byproduct side of things with the processing, looks like do you think there's a lot of upside for the initial 2021 scoping study?
There is a bit of upside. I've read some analyst reports and they flag, I think one number that stood out to me was payability of 107%. So for those wondering, the payability is the amount of product that the company gets paid for from what they produce from their ore.
So is that 107% of the nickel gets
paid? It's of
out?
The nickel, and that's incorporating the extra revenue you'd get from the cobalt and the zinc hydroxide. So that's an interesting sort of number that stands out when you read a report like that.
Looks a pretty good rate of return on capital. Like at $11 a pound nickel, which is what it is today, $2.6 billion NPV with 102% IRR. So
yeah, and look at the grade of the project, right? Like it's easy to see how the economics stack up. And by all accounts, they've got a pretty good working relationship with Brazilians, and a huge Brazilian workforce sort of humming away over there as well. I think it'll be an interesting one to watch that's on that Lassonde curve at the moment.
Absolutely.
And keen to see him become a producer.
Yeah, well, they're only behind BHP. All BHP's got all the top nickel mines. Then it's Centaurus.
Yeah, well, so. For those people watching on YouTube, we'll chuck up a chart and you can see they're 108 million tons at just under 0.9% nickel, And that's just been growing steadily every half year, a year. They're coming out with sort of upgrades. So we'll see what sort of converts over to that resource later. They're now talking open pittable type of project and with an underground component. But a lot of that focus previously was much more underground focus, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think there's what, seven pits by the looks of the plan?
Something along that.
And then I think their updated resource kicking them into over a million ton of contained nickel will be a big kicker for this price.
Have they still got that half-decent undeveloped iron ore project that no one gives them value for, JD?
Yeah, I wouldn't say no one gives them value for it. It's hard to say obviously what the market ascribes to that, but I have seen some analysts that put a figure in the $40 to $50 million range. It's not something I've looked too far into. I've focused really on the nickel side of this company.
Right, let's get on to the Vulcan then. They've got their zero carbon lithium project. This is an interesting one. And Travel won't lie, another one I hadn't heard of till today. So I'm lucky we've got the guru of yourself, Mr. Pessimism, to give us the rundown, mate. I look forward to this.
Quite surprising you hadn't heard of it. This one was making real waves sort of late 2020, 2021, wasn't it, Trav?
Yeah, early 2021. I was still stuck
underground there.
Mate, Vulcan. So they're raising $109 million today. And, geez, there's so much going on here. Like Vulcan, this company to me, it's the epitome of that 2021 craze where everything green friendly just shot straight up in financial markets. And this company, to be honest, completely perplexes me. It's got a hefty valuation. They make pretty big promises and fantastic marketing. So those three things sort of, you know, really hone me in a little bit. So what is this company, right? Like what do they do? Vulcan will tell you that they are a cutting edge zero carbon lithium hydroxide company, a renewable energy developer, and a green chemicals business. Maddie, I'll be the first to admit that I don't have the technical capability to assess the complete veracity of the claims that, you know, Vulcan tries to put out to the market. You know, but the reality is no one does.
Does anyone cover them?
Yeah, they've got coverage. Canaccord cover them. And then there's also a research outfit, which it's well reported that they pay cover them as well. But what I mean by that is, the ASX investors that invest in lithium companies know how to assess mining. This is not mining. This is some pretty niche stuff. And you kind of have to have a very different skill set in order to be able to technically evaluate it. So, but what I do have some degree of expertise in is being able to assess, you know, the marketing and financing dynamics here. And to do that, I'm keen to talk about their DFS, right? So as a bit of context to the Money Miners, we'll put a bit of a chart on the YouTube channel showing a bit of a flow sheet on what it is they're trying to do. But essentially, it's extracting lithium from these thermal brines in Germany. And in the process, also building a renewable energy business on top of that. Now, they've done a bit of technical work and they've put out both a PFS and now recently a DFS to the market. And I want to talk about, you know, some of the numbers and risks baked within that DFS, because I think it's an important thing that we look at. So their phase one CapEx is in euros, 1.5 billion. And they're targeting a 65 to 35 equity, or no, debt to equity split, right? So 65% debt.
And for reference, the company's capped at about 880 million Aussie dollars right now.
Yeah, nearly $1 billion market cap. And it's been north of that in the past. And on their DFS numbers, you get a 26% IRR, you know, based on a lithium hydroxide price that's about US$32,000 per ton average life of mine. Now, like I could make an argument on the price assumptions used here, but I don't even think that's the big thing to talk about. I want to have a broader discussion about, even though they put this DFS out to the market, is this bankable? And what do I mean by that? Like, is it bankable? You know, I think when you think about a bank lending money, it's a completely different equation to an investor investing in a company. The risk dynamics are so different. As a bank lender, you really have to have a degree of certainty or and really understand what the probability of repayment is in order for you to appropriately price that loan that you're about to make. And I think that the things I'm going to point to in the DFS lead me to sort of question whether or not it's actually bankable in its current state. So let's break it down into like three categories that of risks that Vulcan themselves actually do disclose within their DFS on page 69 and 70.
Just to clarify that we're using their information for these risks.
So let's break it into three categories, right? Technology, execution, and resource risks. On the technology front, like the Vulcan, they're planning to convert lithium chloride to a battery-grade LHM with electrolyzers. So a huge part of this process hinges on this electrolysis. And electrolyzers at present, they're not commercially used in lithium salts yet. So that, you know, the second technical risk I think is worth talking about is that they have this proprietary solvent called Volsorb TM. And that's the basis of the numbers that flush through the DFS. And the testing of this Volsorb has been limited to pilot scale, and there isn't a solution for actually manufacturing capability yet.
I sort of want to chime in there as well. So a lot of people accuse the mining industry of being quite a laggard when it comes to incorporating new technology. But I think it's with quite good reason. You know, you don't want to be the one that tries this new technology and it doesn't work. You know, it's not. You don't have that same first mover advantage that you might have in other sectors like technology, where you can just get that advantage and then corner that resource or that technology or whatever. The deposits are still going to be out there. So as a mining company, you wouldn't mind seeing someone try it, see that it works, and then going in and, you know, you might have to pay a bit extra for whatever that technical capability. But
totally. Whenever you speak new technology, I just think it's an equity risk. It's not a debt finance risk.
Yeah, that's what venture capitalists normally finance, and there's not a whole lot of debt involved in venture companies.
Absolutely. So, like, you know, so let's talk about the resource risks, right? So with this whole process, the brine flow rate really matters. And the assumption for the flow rate expected in the brine, in the PFS it was greater than 100 litres per second, and in the DFS it's down to 69 litres per second. And Vulcan themselves note that they can mitigate this risk by undertaking drilling within the resource area. However, they also note that to date there has been no new drilling within the resource area. They are penned to start some in mid-year. However, you know, it's a pretty big unknown, right? And I think that bakes into the technical risk. And that's that, you know, they actually confirm that they're going to be updating their assumptions once the drilling begins. And my question is, if they're going to be updating their knowledge of the resource with this new drilling, if you're a bank financier, you're going to need to wait to see the outcomes of that drilling as it informs the resource and clearly the economics of the project as well. So I think that financing risk piece is going to take a long time to actually come together. There's so many elements here where there's so many degrees of uncertainty that I find it really hard to believe that a bank can get comfortable taking on that risk from a lender perspective. I think the risk here is a lot more analogous to equity-like dynamics. There's, you know, unknown technical risk that has to be taken on, and there's you know a huge amount of kind of uncertainty of the cash flows as a result of that technical risk. That to me, that's what equity investors partake in that kind of risk. So I think aiming for a 65-35 debt to equity split to me doesn't quite stack up. However, you know, the one swing factor I don't have good insight on is the level of green finance actually available in Europe. And you know, maybe there are these financial institutions in Europe that exist and are comfortable with taking on, you know, that kind of risk because, you know, they're mandated to allocate X dollars of capital to initiatives, you know, with ESG credentials.
I wouldn't discredit that either. There's been a huge push, which we've sort of documented and many other people have, about not being able to invest in fossil fuel projects, not being able to invest in coal. It's going into oil as well with some of the biggest financial institutions in the world. And in particular in Europe, I wouldn't be surprised if these banks are sort of pressured to allocate a portion of their loan book into projects like this.
So, and it was interesting, the Warren Irwin interview that you boys did with him. Ed, back and listen to that one, everyone. Brilliant chat with an absolute fun guru. That he doesn't look at lithium at all. I found that very interesting globally.
Well, I just think if you know, if any of these funds that were managing my capital were taking on what I think are equity-like risks in a debt model, I would not be wanting that institution to manage my capital at all.
Yeah, there's one other key advantage that this project has in comparison to a lot of other lithium projects out there. It's the jurisdiction it sits in. So most of the lithium right now comes from Australia and South America. But the Europeans are adamant that they want all the products that become a part of the batteries in these electric vehicles to be sourced and partially refined within Europe. So that gives it a big tick as well, which we shouldn't completely discredit.
I think that's close proximity to what, like Volkswagen, Stellantis, all the big manufacturers over there.
Yeah, and Stellantis has invested in this project as well.
There's, you know, one last thing I want to talk about with Vulcan. Is the way that this company has been reported within the AFR, the Australian Financial Review. You know, and I'll tell you what we can tell from reading these articles, and that's that Vulcan sued Tim Murray and his research house, J Capital, for writing a short thesis research report. That ended up in a settlement, which required a public apology from Tim Murray. And like that kind of thing rubs me the wrong way. Personally, like I would find it so much more admirable if a company that was subject to a short report shrugged it off and just let results speak for themselves. But, you know, granted, like if the report got enough noise, it actually moved markets and it changed that company's cost of capital, then what I want to see management doing is refuting the claims of that report with science-based arguments.
Was there any cost to the settlement, or was it just a public apology?
Oh man, a settlement. You can't find out details of a private settlement, right?
But oh, so there, it's,
but that, a, that sort of thing, you know, requires lawyers. You know, even if there's no monetary exchange, there certainly is a legal fee incurred, right? And time and stress. And so, look, like I want to see the science based arguments. I don't like seeing a strategy where the reporter gets silenced. Now, the diehard lithium market participants, they're likely to be familiar with a guy called Joe Lowry from the consultancy and the podcast Global Lithium. He also had first-hand experience trying and failing to profitably extract lithium from the geothermal brines of California's Salton Sea. And here's what he has to say on Vulcan. This is a direct quote. Vulcan is unlikely to ever produce commercially, and even if they do, they will most likely be at the high end of the cost curve.
So that's a quote from a guy who's generally more on the bullish end. I haven't listened to too much of that Global Lithium podcast. I'm not sure if you guys have. But there's another thing I'd flag about.
Well, if he hasn't been sued, I think we're going to be safe, hopefully.
That's a good point to make though, Matty, right? Like you write a bit here and it's not a glowing review of Vulcan. It's just a little bit of skeptical perspective. And I'm writing it and I'm nervous because the company has a history of silencing critics. So I mean, it's just, It's a perplexing one to me in that regard. I don't like seeing that stuff.
Well, Vulcan is the 15th most shorted from when we last checked earlier today stock on the ASX. So about 7% of their stock has been sold short. And given how little commentary there is regarding these sorts of short positions, you take it a lot of these funds that have decided to go that way about things are just keeping quiet and letting sort of time tell.
I'd be interested to see what the short percentage is after today since they've raised, because that's a bit of a fundy tactic, isn't it? Short when there's a bit of a funding gap, then pick it up on the bottom.
You're all over it, mate.
No worry. I regurgitated what someone else told me there. Hey, you know who you are if you're listening. Very good. Vulcan, done and done. Hopefully we don't get sued. We're about to find out. Don't think so. That's it. It'd be interesting to maybe we could reach out for a bit of advice in this, since we're given a bit of an independent analysis on this. Where is the line? I'd like to know. I don't think you've crossed it. Then you've given.
I'm making
view.
No assessment on, you know, how things stack up technically. I don't have good insight there, Matty. My claim is just that, you know, it's going to take a lot more equity rather than debt, than what I think the company is saying is doable.
From a banking point of view, if you were in the position of working in the investment banking department of lending the money, I guess that's where your point of view is coming from, correct?
Well, I didn't work in project finance, but I work in banking.
Yeah. What's the difference?
Investment banking is M&A mostly, and you know, a bit of ECM, so equity capital markets and mergers and acquisitions. Project finance is a different division where you're assessing, you know, the technical risk of projects and then lending money, earning a return on that. But yeah, different. It's a different sort of thing.
There you go, Trav. That CV that old mate was looking for, very good. Right, let's get into the other news that is out there. Right, Ramelius has gained a controlling interest in Breaker Resources, BRB, RMS, and their bid has now become unconditional. Global Lithium announced that a large-scale exploration program is underway. They're kicking off a 50,000-metre RC and diamond drilling program at Manna, 20,000-plus metres at also at Marble Bar. And the management team at Mincor have now sold into Wyloo's bid. So that's a handy payday for all those performance rights which have now vested. And Chalice, they've had some interesting hits from the Hooley prospect. So this is the one that's 5K north of the big, their flagship Gonneville deposit. It's within the state park. Caspian, they've had a rare earth discovery at their Mount Squires project, up 30% in early trade. And Northern Star released their annual mineral resource and ore reserve statement. So growth of 3 million ounces in resource. So their total resource now sits at 57.4 million ounces. And why not do a little quiz? I thought I'd let's do a little test of you two about the 57.4 million ounce resource of Northern Star and how much each site holds. Are you willing to play a game, boys?
Let's do it.
Why not? So if you were to say out of that 57 million, how many would Pogo have?
Oh, eight.
Eight?
Ten.
Trav's close, 7.3 for Pogo. Jundee?
12.
8.
5.3. So out of the 57 million, KCGM, so Super Pit Mount Charlotte, that whole.
26?
Mate, he's just going A minus B equals C here. Yeah. Well, the answer's implied. Come on, Matty.
How much? 26? What do you reckon, Trav, for the Super Pit Mount Charlotte?
27.
Pretty close, 28. So half their resources in the super pit.
Yeah.
Then there's Carasu Dam, South Cal, KB and all that as well. But they're the big ones. So very interesting.
A lot of
games. Yeah. Good stuff. Right, Uteroo Money Miners. I am going to have a glass of water and go to sleep.
Good stuff,
Matt. I will edit this, yes. Cheers, lads.
Uteroo.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.